are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old Rockin' Chair's got me.
Old Rockin' Chair got your father.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look here on KBOO. I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. Today we're talking about Gaza. The current bombardment of this small sliver of Palestine began July 8th, under siege by Israel since 2008 and occupied since the Six-Day War in 1967. Gaza is now considered by many experts to be the world's largest outdoor prison, really the world's largest prison of any sort. According to the International Media Center, the International Middle East Media Center, since July 8th in Gaza, 1,901 Palestinians have been killed, including 432 children, 243 women, and 374 elderly. A total of 9,886 Palestinians have been injured, including 2,878 children, 1,854 women, and 374 elderly. According to the UN High Commission on Human Rights, 66 Israelis have been killed and one Thai national. I did hear another report that there were three Israelis. I could not verify that when I went looking for numbers online. So I believe these are the most up-to-date numbers we have now. There's currently a truce going on. Talks between Israel and Hamas started in Egypt on Monday morning and have been extended for 5 days, the truce has been. Violations have been reported by both sides, but in general, the truce appears to be continuing. My guest today is Jerry Haynes. She's a nurse with expertise in palliative care and grief and bereavement. She's a board member and the former president of Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and has led numerous educational and medical delegations throughout the Middle East, including to Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, and Syria. She's been to Gaza 6 times, most recently returning in April from a medical mission there. Over the years, she's developed lasting relationships with many of her Palestinian colleagues and she's worked with in Gaza and is in daily contact with her friends there to ascertain what they're going through and what's happening to them and what they need, and mostly because I think it keeps her sane to be able to speak to them. Welcome to KBOO, Jerry Haynes.
Thank you very much.
I'm so glad to have you here to talk to us, to bring us a more personal view of this large event. I know that you have gone to Gaza 6 times. Can you just start with a little bit of background about this type of trip and what you're doing when you go there, why you're going?
Sure. We actually started with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility in January of 1993 to make educational trips into the Middle East, Gaza, and the West Bank, and Israel. And then in 2009, after The CAS-led, what's called CAS-led, we decided that probably we should start doing medical service trips and take medical professionals in to offer service.
And that CAS-led, was the last major bombardment where we in the public of the world had to sit and watch Palestinians being, bombarded from Israel.
Well, in 2012, there was another bombardment that didn't last as long, but significant damage was done. And we were in Gaza then in 2012 as well. So since October of 2009, we have made 6 medical trips into give service, and we're going back, we hope, in October. And you're correct. We have formed long-term relationships with many of our professional colleagues there and are looking forward to helping participate in ongoing education, because with the siege of Gaza, it has been very difficult to impossible for people to go and come to upgrade their medical education, as well as there are problems getting in sufficient medicines and medical equipment.
You know, Jerry, I was a little confused about or wanted to ask you about how it is. We know of many of us have heard in the news of the flotillas that were traveling to Gaza to try to bring supplies that the siege was keeping from getting in. Can you talk a little bit about what the impact of the siege, but also how is it that your organization is able to bring in supplies?
Oh, good question. Well, the flotillas have gone in without permission from Israel, and so then Israel apparently feels as though it has to defend itself against people coming in without permission, even though you and I know that they are bringing in humanitarian aid that is desperately needed. When our groups go in, we apply through Israel and through the Palestinians, both in Ramallah and in Gaza, to enter and to bring in the medicines and supplies that we bring in. So we get permission, and it takes generally 2 to 3 months to get that permission, going through various channels of increasing bureaucracy. But indeed, we've had assistance on all sides of the question to help us get in, because we're so forthright about what it is that we want to do.
And it's directly medical.
It's directly medical. We teach, we give care. Among our physicians, we've been taking with us a pediatric urologist who has operated on many, many children who have need for corrective surgery. We have a cardiologist who goes in and teaches advanced life support, as well as seeing patients. We have an emergency room physician who also teaches advanced life support. And in our most recent journey, we took in with us a trauma surgeon from Harborview in Seattle, and he is doing some planning for advanced training in for surgical residencies. And also, we've had an adult urologist and a pediatrician whose specialty is autism, and he has run clinics for us. So we have a broad spectrum of medical professionals. We have a neurosurgeon who travels with us, who does consultations in neurosurgery. We're very blessed to have a broad spectrum of specialists who are willing to pay their own way and go in and take their vacation to go there, because they feel that it's such a blight on our humanity about what's happening to the medical community as well as the broad community in Gaza.
And so while your surgeons are doing surgeries, they're also working with surgeons there, showing new techniques, planning surgeries, planning. I hadn't thought about that, but I was reading. You can go to, I believe it's WPSR.org, and read a lot about these trips. And one of the things that I was reading, these are like daily journals from the trip, was about them planning out surgeries and working with surgeons there on how to plan out a surgery perhaps that they've never had to do before, because the injuries that are presented are so, devastating or different. That sounds very advanced. It's both being able to give the care but train the caregivers.
And absolutely essential, because the medical professionals in Gaza are of very high quality in their primary training, and their will to learn and be current is extremely high. It's a highly educated population, everyone in the medical community speaks English, teaches in English, charts in English, so that the issue of translation is almost not an issue at all. When I go, I teach about grief and bereavement, and if there is any problem at all, there's always a translator standing right next to me to answer any questions. But we have developed, again, these wonderful relationships with the people in Gaza, and the people in Gaza universally are welcoming to us and celebratory about our being there and really want this siege to end so that they can become an integrated part of the world again.
Now, I understand that you did visit the Islamic University and work with nurses there. I believe that university was bombed this time.
It was. In fact, the area where we enter into Islamic University was destroyed, which is heartbreaking because it's such a symbol of higher learning, and the people that we have met at Islamic University have worked so diligently to continue to upgrade the education of the students who go there.
Can you talk about, I want to hear what you have to say about what you've learned about the current conditions under this bombardment, but can you talk a little bit about the overall general living conditions that you see when you've traveled to Gaza? And
sure.
Maybe give us some individual stories, people you know, what they have to go through to be, say, a nurse or a doctor there.
Oh, that's a broad question. But...
yeah, I know. I'll let you hone in. You pick.
No, let me just say that the situation in Gaza varies widely, that there are extremely poor people who have lost their homes because of bombardment. And over these three major wars in the last few years, many thousands of homes have been destroyed. The situation is tribal in Gaza, so that if my home is destroyed, my uncle will take me into his home, but if his home is destroyed, all of us will go to another relative, so that one of my friends was staying in a home, and these are like four-level small apartment homes, and that home held 100 people.
Oh,
and
my.
Those 100 people then were trying to comfort each other, and yet recognizing that under bombardment, all 100 people are in intimate danger. And one of my friends, who is the director of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, was in his home, and his extended family was in Shajaya, and 26 of them were killed instantaneously with a non-warned bombardment. Another of
that
my
was
friends,
during this time.
That's this time, right? And another of my friends during this time, who is a psychologist at Gaza Community Mental Health, was away from his family home, and his mother and three of his brothers, one of his sisters-in-law and a nephew, I believe, were all killed. So that story was written up, in fact, in the New York Times, because it's very difficult. And you can imagine this, if you are a caregiver, a mental health caregiver, and all of a sudden the grief that comes into your personal life is so intense, you have to be able to supersede a lot of feelings to be able to go out into the community and continue to help.
Well, and being a mental health practitioner does not immunize you to post-traumatic stress.
No, it
you
doesn't.
Know, it doesn't mean that you won't start shaking every time there's a big blast.
Oh, of course. And every single person in Gaza has known that trauma. When I go there, I don't teach about PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. We talk about CTSI, which is continuous traumatic stress injury, because the people of Gaza are continuously injured. I was teaching in a class of a lot of mental health professionals, and one of the women said to me, my 8-year-old son comes home every day from school, and this is in between bombardments. This is during a time of peace. He comes home from school and says to me, Mama, what if we are bombed today? And she said, I don't know what to say to him, because I can't say to him, no, it won't happen. It's not reasonable to think it won't happen, because it happens so often. You know, we talk about these three major bombardments in 2008, 9, 2012, and now this one. But indeed, I believe that there hasn't been a time that I've been in Gaza over these last years that somewhere hasn't been shelled or bombarded or bombed in Gaza during the time that I was there, or just before, or just after. So it, while this is a really concentrated and huge bombardment, it's not unusual for the people of Gaza to awaken and say, oh, there was a bomb that was dropped out in the what's called the no-go zone.
That's a whole area that could have been agricultural but is made unavailable to be, you're not allowed to farm it. They'll bomb you.
That's right. It's fully one-third of the farming area of Gaza is off limits because it abuts the long land barrier with Israel. Now, Gaza is a tiny area.
Jerry, let me interrupt you just for a second to remind our audience of who you are. I'm speaking with Jerry Haynes. She's a consulting palliative care nurse and has expertise in grief and bereavement. And she's also been a leader of and a participant in delegations that have traveled to Gaza six times. The most recent returned in April, and she will be going back in October, or has plans for going back in October. Yes, so when you're talking about the conditions that people face, there's no stability is what it sounds like to me. And I've also read that the aquifer underneath Gaza, the source of water, is being poisoned through much of this bombardment and efforts as well.
Well, I mean, the natural aquifer, which has fed Gaza its water for all these many years, is being overrun by saline because it's overpumped. One of the reasons that it apparently is overpumped is that Israel has drilled wells along the long land border, and so the water that might replenish the aquifer is taken away. I have a 44-year-old friend in Gaza. I said to him, how long has it been since you've put a glass under a tap and taken a glass of water from the tap? And he looked at me curiously and said, I've never done that. It's never been safe to do that.
Wow. And so when things are during a bombardment, people really suffer with about food and water, as well as the terror of all that's happening.
Absolutely. And right now, even as of this morning when I talked to my friend in Gaza, he tells me that they have 3 to 5 hours of electricity on and then 12 hours off. But during that 3 to 5 hours, they have power surges, and the power surges can knock out the refrigeration system or a computer that might be turned in. So even on the time that they have electricity, it's not reliable and even sometimes dangerous. And terrible disasters have happened when the lights are out because people use candles, and then there are fires and sorrows happen. But imagine now that you are in Gaza, and I think it's so important for each of us to close our eyes for a minute and imagine that we are asleep with our children gathered around us and bombs are going off, so that it's so close that the building next to us shudders and our windows rattle, and we don't know how we're going to protect not only ourselves, but of course, how are we going to protect our children and make them feel as though they can grow up in a world that is reliable and accountable? The siege has to end. The siege of these people must end. 1.7 or 1.8 million people are at risk, and we are creating no friends for either Israel or the United States by the situation as it exists.
Can you talk a little bit about the tunnels? They're made quite a bit of by Israel, claiming that they're the main way that illegal weapons get into and contraband gets into Gaza. Tell me what you know about the tunnels and what role they play in Gaza, both during and not during bombardments.
Sure. Well, I've been to the tunnel area a number of times and, in fact, gone down into the entry to several of the tunnels. The tunnels were primarily used for transportation of goods and building materials, and of course some of that concrete that was used to build the other tunnels had to come through those tunnels. But I mean, camels came through the tunnels.
Camels. I hadn't imagined camels coming through them.
little cars, brides, came through the tunnels. But when this new government came into Egypt, the tunnels were sealed. So the last time we were down there, there was practically no activity in the Rafah area of the tunnels. Now, these tunnels that Israel has been destroying, as Norman Finkelstein so adeptly stated, all Israel had to do was exactly what the Egyptians did and seal those tunnels. All of this destruction, all of this death, all of this horror didn't have to happen. With the expertise that Israel has to block those tunnels, that could have happened, and then ongoing peace negotiations could have happened. But that's not what happened. And so there is this, again, huge sorrow. And Israel has lost, what, 66,
I believe, people have been.
Including civilians.
Yeah, and just, right. I've only heard of three civilians in one report, but I haven't been able to see the others. But if you're a relative of one of those civilians, of course, the grief is as deep as it is anywhere.
Absolutely.
And we don't wish for anyone to die on either side or to be in terror on either side.
That's absolutely true. And let me just say that in our entry into Gaza, we have been assisted in that process by Israelis who have helped us find a way in, including the Israeli embassy helped us at 1 year to find our way in so that we could provide this service. So we have friends on both sides of this issue who want this process to end. The Gaza Community Mental Health Program, I talked with an agent of that program this morning, and of course you can imagine with a huge level of trauma that exists in Gaza, that program, which is the majority, provides the majority of mental health services in Gaza, is overwhelmed by the amount of work that they have to do. And I don't know if you're able for me to tell you this, but there is a way to donate to them here in the United States.
Well, I did see physician. You can go ahead and mention it. I was going to mention it later as one thing someone can do. I believe that it's Psychiatrists for Social Responsibility have asked people to fund the community, the Gaza Community Mental Health Center.
Well, or the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, which is called GazaMentalHealth.org. Has a way for people to donate. And those are tax-deductible donations. Also, you can donate. We will be taking in medicines and supplies when we go in October, and you can donate through WPSR, www.wpsr.org. And I don't usually go out saying send a lot of money, but the needs are so desperate right now. So that if you wanted to donate and have us take in things, we would happily and gratefully do that, and you just need to note Gaza on your donation. One of the things
I will link to both of these sites. I've already linked to WPSR on our website under the schedule of this episode for today, so you can just look at a deeper looks this episode, and there should be links to everything except the GazaMentalHealth.org. So do keep that one in mind as well, our dear listeners, because we want people to take action, and maybe we're sort of moving into that a little bit more. We don't have a whole lot of time. I know that I wanted to let people know that if they want to find more information about the current situation in Gaza on a timely basis, you can always go to imemc.org. That's the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem, and it does a good job of up-to-date coverage of, a couple days ago, some fishermen were fired on, all of that kind of thing, as well as it tries to keep an accurate count, and it has a full list of all of the names of the Palestinians, or actually it's not all of the names, of all of the names that they could verify of Palestinians who have been killed during this bombardment. There's also organizations asking people to call President Obama. I don't know if you had heard yet that Obama's administration has said that it's going to put a hold on the transfer of Hellfire missions to Israel. Can you say something about that from your perspective?
Well, that's sort of the only first step that this administration has taken to really stop the disaster that's going on, which is to put a hold, and that was just announced within the last 24 hours, put a hold on some of these ammunitions or weapons that the United States provides to Israel. Israel receives more foreign aid than any other country on earth from the United States. And a lot of that has to do with weapons and munitions. So I was cheered to see that there's been a statement saying we don't want our tax dollars used for killing people in this, in the way that this is happening. I'm eager to see what transpires from this.
I do notice, and I mean, this last Saturday, reports are saying that there were up to 150,000 people protesting in Cape Town, South Africa, 100,000 in London. We had a couple hundred here in Portland, and many, many, many other sites throughout the world had larger and numbers of people, and had people coming out to say, you know, Israel, stop the bombardment, and the U.S., stop arming them. I felt a little heartened by that. I feel like something has changed. The air has changed a little bit this time. Do you?
Well, I hope so. I really hope and hope and hope that it has, because, you know, I am not an antagonist of Israel. I want people on all of this region to be able to live peacefully together. But as long as we continue to make money by selling weapons, I can't see that happening. So when we start putting our money toward peace building, I'll be a whole lot happier than I am right now.
Yes, I can tell. Now, can you tell us anything more, just briefly, about the conditions that your colleagues in Gaza are facing and how they're being able to meet them?
Well, our primary colleagues are in the hospitals, where, of course, the trauma that has happened is incredibly severe, and the nurses that I'm in touch with are working without ever going home on the nights when the bombardments go up. Again, the people at the mental health organization have hired a couple of new people, and they're forming teams that will go into their trauma clinics, crisis groups that will go into schools and provide families with psychological help, and that is a program in process and in further planning. And again, there is not one person that's untraumatized in that area, so the more support that we can give to them from the United States, the better off we will be as a humanitarian nation.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining me today, Jerry Haynes, consulting nurse with Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. I believe you can read your blog by going to WPSR.org. I think,
or you can read it by going to www.LarryJohnsonOnline.org.
LarryJohnsonOnline.org. Mm-hmm. So please do. There are other sites, the Electronic Intifada, that I've linked to on our website. Please do that. And thank you again. And we look forward to your trip in October and hearing from you about the work you do there then.
Linda, thank you. And thanks to everyone who was willing to listen and to participate in helping the people of Gaza, and really the people of Israel, who there are tens of thousands of people in Israel also demonstrating against what's happened.
And they don't want these deaths on their hands either.
Absolutely, they do not.
All right. Well, thank you. I now have another announcement I want to do really briefly for you, the audience. I want to let you know that this is my second to last show. I'm retiring A Deeper Look after my next show in August 21st. And I'm doing that because I'm not leaving KBOO. I love KBOO. I love participating in KBOO, and I love being a programmer. But I've felt for a little while like I'm coming to the end of what I want to do with this kind of program. So I'm going to retire it. It'll open up the spot for other people to make proposals, and I'm going to be proposing a different kind of program for myself. You can always hear me Friday nights. I anchor the Friday evening news, and I'll be happy to see you then. And I thank you all for listening to me in particular. Do turn in for the August 21st show of A Deeper Look. It will be my last episode, and we will be taking a look back.
Thank you, Linda. You are listening to KBOO Portland just about a minute before 10 o'clock. Coming up on your Thursday morning in 15 minutes, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman explores the sci-fi world of sleep donation. created by author Karen Russell. In her book, a crisis of insomnia has swept across America, and healthy dreamers are recruited to donate sleep to the insomniacs under the watchful eye of the Storch Brothers Corporation. At 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, KBOO's monthly program on comics and animation. The show will feature comics artist Lucy Bellwood, who has teamed up with journalists to report on Islamic environmentalists and the women of Gitmo, and will have a show in Portland this September. That's all coming up this morning on KBOO. Up next, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Stick around. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. Now, not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio and Triangle Productions are proud to co-sponsor the return of Medicarefully Fabulous. Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th, Medicarefully Fabulous will return to the Sanctuary Theater for a limited engagement. The show is a series of original stories about aging, faith, friendships, and recovery. Again, that's Medicarefully Fabulous, Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Cascadia. Today is Thursday, August 14th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We have a lot of guests to get to. We've got three people to speak to today. There are headlines, which I can try to put up on the KBOO website, but we want to get right straight away speaking with Helen Yost with the Clean Skies Campaign from Montana and Wyoming to the West Coast. Dozens of communities are impacted.